The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to do. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek and they met it with a bat. Fucking protesting them sinners. Told you go fight in the war. Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around and pump crack right up when you did it. And they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called the National Guard up because we ride with our guard up. And now it's blood in your guard. It's like an amendment on the fly. To you, everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. So one day you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon and welcome to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I broadcast from behind these enemy lines known as USA Inc., or I should more accurately say maintained by USA Inc. For those who don't know what USA Inc. means, that means that the government in Washington, D.C. is actually a corporation that incorporated in 1871, because, you know, it's important to know these things. It's important to call those things that be as they are. And the fact is that we have a corporation that gives lots of favors to other corporations over and above of the interests of the people that they are charged with governing. So that's why I say USA Inc. When I open up the broadcast, just want to share a bit of that history. Because today's program, we will also be discussing history. Well, I don't know if I can have a discussion by myself, so let me give the telephone number, because I am also interested in hearing opinions. If you can tell from the title of the show, it says Why Names Matter in the USA. And not just names, but symbolism. You know, statutes, flags, and those things do matter. We have done programs in the past where we have talked to activists about why they want to pull down the Virginia battle flag from the State House Capitol grounds in South Carolina after the vicious murder of 9 black people in the Charleston church. We have seen Black Lives Matter, or we don't know who actually has done this, but here in Charlotte, North Carolina, also I've seen in Boston where these monuments to racist white men have been vandalized. I think the latest one was this guy who was instrumental in establishing a I guess you would call it a mission or whatever, in California. And when the Pope came here to visit, he gave this man sainthood, and the indigenous descendants whose ancestors had been harshly treated by this man and by what he brought to California. You know, they vandalized his little statue and whatnot. And so, you know, for some people, you know, these things do matter. They do matter as they are a reflection of the society in which people live. And I, for one, do not think that tax dollars of my family or any of the other families around here who don't agree with erecting monuments to people who believed in the mythology of white supremacy and joined the Confederacy so that they could fight for their future rights to enslave Africans, you know, I don't think those people should be honored with my tax dollars. If you want to honor them, that's totally fine. As they say, you know, this is a free country, even though it's not. So I don't even want to say that. But, you know, long as you're not harming anyone else, I certainly believe that you have a right to, hell, if you want to erect a statue to Hitler on your front lawn, that's totally up to you. I wouldn't recommend something like that, but that's hey, your property, that's your business. I'm not here to tell you what to do on your property. But when it comes to communal property, when it comes to the property that is supported by everyone's tax dollars, no, I'm not falling for that. And I think it's important. And I actually had a conversation today with a Seattle-based activist, Mr. Jonathan Rosenblum, who finally saw some resolution to an 8-year fight that he had. And he, of course, had his supporters, but the 8-year fight that he had to change the racist name of a lake in that state, in Washington, in the mountains of Washington State, to change the name from Coon Lake, which is a racial epithet that has been used to refer to black people, non-white people. And so he wanted to change the name back to the original name, all right, to honor the African descendant frontiersman and prospector who was one of the first to settle in that area. And I'm talking about Wilson Howard. And the lake was named Howard Lake before it was changed to Coon Lake. And so now it's been changed back after people like Mr. Rosenblum took the initiative to correct something in a place that they lived that they felt like was incorrect, that he felt like was racist. So I had an opportunity to speak with him earlier today and conduct a interview with him, and we will listen to that interview here shortly. Some of the other things that's catching my eye in the news, of course, Minneapolis is seeing a lot of activists associated with Black Lives Matter, as well as, you know, just people in the community that care. They don't necessarily have any political affiliations or affiliated or belong to a group, but they saw something that's wrong and they want to say something. They want to participate. So you're seeing a lot of people participate in Minneapolis in demonstrations, acts of nonviolent civil disobedience taking place there in the city. They are demanding video of the encounter that a young man, I think he was like 26 years old, Jamar Clark, who was taken off of life support. I think it was either last night or earlier this morning, taken off life support, where he died from the head wound he received after being shot in the head by members of the Minneapolis Police Department. And many people in that community feel like the shooting is under suspicious circumstances, and they're demanding that a video of the encounter that Mr. Clark had with the modern day slave catchers, they want that video made public. So apparently some video must exist. Maybe they had body cams, maybe they had cams in the vehicle or whatnot. So it appears that some video does exist. They're demanding the release. Other people up there are actually calling for the Justice Department to get involved. And, you know, I just don't see a whole lot coming from the Justice Department. I just don't have any faith in the Justice Department to implement justice, since they've been such a long historic source of injustice in this country. And certainly we saw after their investigation of Ferguson, where they, you know, issued this report, much anticipated report, that documented all of these racist patterns and practices, and even said in that report that federal statutes, federal laws had been violated. But look, nobody was arrested, nobody was prosecuted for the violations of federal law. People were allowed to, you know, retire or, you know, leave and whatnot. I think it was a judge who was forced into retirement there. I could be incorrect. But, you know, still, there was no no serious repercussions for them terrorizing and extorting money from the poor African Americans of that city. So I don't have too much faith in the Justice Department at all. I've seen throughout, you know, my research on the issue, these consent decrees that and these agreements where they agree to have a federal monitor and whatnot, and they promise not to practice racism anymore. I've seen that, you know, consent decrees from the 70s. I saw one specifically related to Philadelphia that was put together by the Justice Department in the 1970s. They're still, Philadelphia still has racist patterns in practice. And that's even with a showcase black man as the city police commissioner or whatever his title is. Who was also on President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force. And this man has a spotty record at best of his own abuses at several different police departments. So I just don't have any faith whatsoever. Yeah, you go through the motions. You might be able to get some, uncover some information that you might could use later. I would really wish that some of our people in the legal community would start going after these police departments in these cities and filing civil RICO charges cases on them, you know, because again, I want to keep reiterating this point. Just because the Justice Department comes in doesn't mean there's going to be an implementation of justice. All right. Nobody's going to be punished for violating the rights of black people and whatnot. And they'll just basically get a public admonishment is what we'll call it, a public admonishment. But that's pretty much about it. That's all I've seen. So, yeah, I want to talk about Minneapolis. Now, we do have a guest coming on tomorrow, an activist from Wisconsin. So yeah, I'm thinking about the wrong thing here. I'm thinking Milwaukee. That's in Wisconsin. So I'm looking forward to that interview tomorrow. But we do have in my circle of friends and comrades in the new abolitionist movement, Nakia Levy Pounds. I think she is the state president or chapter president of the NAACP up there, but she's really, you know, representing Black Lives Matter more than she's representing the NAACP. She is a former attorney, attorney of the year for that state, Minnesota. Yeah, attorney of the year, law professor. And she's a new abolitionist, meaning that she recognizes the fact that the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. It only amended slavery. And what we have now is not mass incarceration, but it's mass enslavement. It's a continuation of slavery in a different form, but it's the same old evil. All right. And so I will be reaching out to her. Perhaps we can get her to come on Friday and give us an update as much as she would like to share about what's going on up there in Minneapolis. But I will talk about this case later in today's program. Now, also, there was a study that was published. It came out maybe a week or two ago, and I haven't really seen, you know, many people talking about it here lately because, you know, I guess it made its social media rounds and now it's, you know, in the dustbin or whatnot. But I want to dust it off and I want to pull it back up. And I'm talking about the Pew Research Center, which published a study examining why the death rates among whites are exceeding the birth rates. And I read that study. I can't remember what prompted me to take a look back at it. I think I was reading yesterday. Yeah, I think I was talking about yesterday from some of the reports from the databases that are being kept to record all the police involved shootings of civilians. And it said something about over 400 unarmed white people have been gunned down by police, which doesn't really get a lot of attention. And I've talked about in the past the reasons why they don't want to showcase white people getting killed by police, because they don't want to rile up white people and get white people to see themselves as victims of the police and start a mass movement of their own. But I think that's what got me thinking about this study I had heard of about white deaths exceeding white births. And I noticed when I read that, it's not a very long report, and I linked to it if you want to take a look at it. But there was a big glaring omission. It's a big omission, something that they perhaps didn't think of or purposely left out. I can't say either way, but it was certainly a glaring omission to me. And I will talk about that. Again, I do not plan to stay on air more than I need to. If I need to go over an hour, I will go over an hour. Yesterday we was on air for 2 hours, but Tando Radio Show will be coming on live at 6 o'clock p.m. today. Oh, by the way, did I give the date? Today's date is November 17th, 2015. It's a Tuesday afternoon here in North Carolina, where I broadcast from. So, yeah, Tando Radio Show will be coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Also, another media partner, Why You Mad Son Radio, will be on air tonight. And I saw the topic of discussion, but I forgot what it was. I saw it yesterday. Sister Child Boogie posted that discussion. You can check them out on Facebook at Why You Mad Son Radio on Facebook, but they will be live on air tonight at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. So just to inform you about some things that's going on the digital radio station, Black Talk Radio Network, providing you with new black media for this new millennium. So let me give out the phone numbers, because I'm interested in your opinions. Do you think that names matter? Do you think that, like, for example, I know the students on Clemson University and other campuses have worked to change the names from like Tillman Hall, which is named after Benjamin Tillman, one of the founders of Clemson University and another university in this area, as well as he was a former U.S. senator. But what really sticks out to me is that he was admitted. It wasn't like he was trying to hide it, or this isn't widely known, but he's a terrorist. He's a white terrorist who preyed upon and terrorized black people. And some of his followers even assassinated a black U.S. congressman. It might have been a congressman. I don't think he was a senator. But yeah, they even assassinated a black man. And so do you think that is correct for murderers and terrorists to be given places of honor on campuses where black people also pay tuition, and you're making the bulk of your money, like a Clemson University, off the black bodies of the black athletes, you know? And if it offends a black person, if it offends a black person, then, you know, who are we not to support them in their efforts to counter racism? I think we should be supporting them. I mean, like, I'm thinking about John Sims talking about this as passive aggressive visual terrorism. And why do we want to see black people terrorized? I don't understand that. I don't understand why we want to see black, some of us, I shouldn't say all of us, but some of us want to see black people continually subjected to indignities throughout this society. And so anyway, I really appreciate the effort of Mr. Rosenblum in his counter-racist efforts to change the name of a lake back to its original name, which was honoring a black person, because, you know, black people do matter in the historical context of the founding of this country, and you know, the just the settlement of this land, and that history is really, really hidden from everyone. It's hidden from everyone, and there's got to be a reason why they don't want you to know about black people fighting in the American Revolutionary, not the ones who were substitutes for their racist, white, cowardly plantation owners and whatnot, because, white people who enslaved Africans, if they was too scared, or if they was too old or something like that, they could send an enslaved African in their place to fight in the American Revolution. That's not really talked about a lot. But there were a lot of free black people that also participated. So, you know, knowing history is important in recognizing black people who have made contributions to this land is important as well. And, you know, that's just how I feel about it. So if you feel differently or if you have a different perspective that you would like to share, please do so after this interview wraps up. It's about 20 minutes long. But you can give us a call at 641-715-3660. That's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032 pound. That's 549-032 pound. For those already dialed in and listening through their phones, just hit *6 and 1 at any time to comment on air. The other way you can get into the station, into my home studio, is to give me a call on the studio line, which is 704-951-5030. That's 704-951-5030. All right, so now that I have laid groundwork for what is the program for today, let's go ahead and go into this interview that I had conducted earlier today with Mr. Jonathan Rosenblum, who is a Seattle-based social activist in the state of Washington. Joining us on Black Talk Radio News today is Jonathan Rosenblum. He is a Seattle-based activist, social justice activist, and he recently had a success in helping to change the name of a lake in north central Washington state, which was called Coon Lake and has been changed to Howard Lake. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Rosenblum.
Thanks very much. Good to be on your show.
The first question I would like to ask, I know this has been an 8-year-long process. What got the process started, and meaning, what made you, as the original petitioner of the federal government to change the name, what was your motivation?
Well, I first found out about the lake when I met the person who would become my wife, and she invited me to come up to this cabin in the mountains that she and her family had been in her family for 70 years. Her grandparents had lived there. Her mom had been born and raised there. And it's a beautiful place in the middle of the North Cascade Mountains with mountains and rivers and beautiful vistas all around. And we would go on these hikes. And one day we took a hike to this lake, and it was called Coon Lake. And when I got back to the cabin, I asked her mom about the origin of the name, because it seems strange. We knew there were no raccoons in the area. And she said, why, yes, of course, it's a racist name. It was named after a black miner who staked claims there a century ago. So I began asking around other people in the mountain community about that, and they confirmed, no, there's no raccoons. And some of the elders confirmed that there had been a black miner, and I went and looked through the mining records of Washington State and found that indeed there was a Wilson Howard who had staked claims, and that matched up with the name that some of the elders in the community had given me. And so I petitioned the state of Washington to change the name. That was about 10 years ago, close to 10 years ago.
Well, let me ask you this. So, it would be correct to say that whoever, and if you had that information, whoever named the lake had that kind of authority. So they meant it as a racial slur towards Mr. Wilson Howard?
Well, you know, nobody put down in writing, we're going to name this Coon Lake as a racial slur. But here's the history. In 1891 and 92, Mr. Howard staked claims there. And a few years later, he left the community. But he had a cabin up by the lake, and it was known as Howard Lake. As early as 1902, there are records of the white settlers who remained renaming it Coon Lake. People talk about taking hikes to a Coon Lake and, looking at the lake and naming it Coon Lake. And so, beginning in the very early part of the 20th century, that name became the commonly held name, and it became part of official records. It was on official maps and so on. And when tourists come, that's the lake name that they're given when they go there. And it's the trail sign on, you know, it's right on the side, the head of the trail as you go to the lake. It says Coon Lake. And, you know, I thought as a Jewish person, I thought this was offensive, and that even if it didn't affect me directly, I needed to, that it was wrong, and we needed to right this wrong, and end this discrimination. Even if you couldn't point to a document where somebody said, we're naming this after Mr. Howard, come on, the facts line up pretty clearly, that this had a racist connotation to it, and we needed to get rid of it.
Had you heard of anyone else? I don't know what the population of minorities, or specifically black people, are in that area, but had you ever heard of anyone else complaining about the name, or it was just, you know, just a part of the landscape?
It's a very small community in this valley. It's called Pekin, and it's a very white community. There's only a few dozen people who live there year round. But even broader, out in the, you know, in Washington State, you know, most of the state is white. But I'd never heard anybody, and very few people knew about the lake's existence for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'd never heard anybody complain. You know, I had heard, some of my white friends say, well, that's just the way it is, or, you know, it's part of the historical record, and you know, nobody had thought that it was offensive enough to do something about. I thought that it was a wrong, and we have to change this for two reasons. One is it's offensive on a racist basis, and secondly, it's wrong on the basis of e-racism, that here you have a history where Mr. Howard trekked into the wilderness and set up a cabin and tried to make it, right? And it's a tremendous history of fortitude and probably a lot of solitude, too, for that matter. The lake had been named Howard Lake, and by erasing that name from the record, we were really literally erasing the record of this African-American miner. And that was a wrong that also needed to be fixed.
As a, I would consider myself amateur historian. History has always been my favorite subject, and you know, I have often said on my program of late is that I always hear, you know, a lot of black people automatically assume that they are the descendants of enslaved Africans, even though, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, your ancestors are who your ancestors are. But I found it to be incorrect and quite telling that every person, every white person that speaks of the African descendant people on this continent and the African descendant people themselves automatically assume that every black person is a descendant of enslaved Africans. And in doing research on the county that I live in, Gaston County here in North Carolina, of course, North Carolina being one of the original 13 colonies, and one of my ancestors, a Scots-Irish man, some brothers who migrated here from Pennsylvania after coming from Scotland, and now I'm black, you know, because their descendants, some of their descendants, my direct descendant, Mary Cherokee woman, who were native to this area that I live in, and then their children all marry African descendant people. So I am an African descendant person. That's what's on my birth certificate and whatnot. And but I found out though researching the history and just my family history here is that there was a huge population of free Africans here, about North Carolina cent, at least from the records I've seen, 400 men to fight in the militias in the American Revolution, and whatnot. And so I was like, you know, this is direct proof that, you know, every African descended person on this continent is not the descendant of enslaved Africans, and that each and every person, your family history, you should do the research, because you will find out a lot of things that aren't taught. So I agree with you. I said all that to say, I agree with you that it is important to recognize Mr. Howard, being that he was a pioneer in that particular area, and this just restores the true history of that area instead of you know, the mocking name that it was called, Coon Lake. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on what I said?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd say, Scotty, that's a wonderful, rich story, and it underscores why names matter. During the course of the last so many years, you know, sometimes people, friends even, would say, you know, what's the big deal here? And your story really answers that names matter, because names tell us about our history, about our connection to the past, to our ancestors, to past places and historical events, and that's why names do matter. And it did matter that in this case, with a small, fairly obscure lake in north central Washington state, it does matter to restore its historical name, to in a small way lift up the history of Mr. Howard. And I would say beyond that, it creates a conversation, a wider conversation in the community, about the importance of names, and also about not just the legacy of racism, but the present day racism that we still have throughout society. And that's where things get a little bit more energetic in some conversations that I've had in the last few months.
You know, here in Gaston County, which used to be known as Tryon County after Governor Tryon, the British, you know, appointed governor of this area, of this colony. Well, it was called Tryon County, and it split it into three: Lincoln County, Gaston County, and Cleveland County. Cleveland County is where Dylan Roof, the perpetrator of the murders that occurred at the church down there in Charleston, South Carolina, he was caught in Cleveland County. And this area has really been known for, you know, Ku Klux Klan, you know, racism, and people who believe in the myth of white supremacy. And we have a number of monuments to Confederate soldiers. And I have taken issue with that, because there's one monument at the polling place that I go to, where I go to vote. My family goes to vote. There's a monument to the regiments that, you know, sent about 1,800 people, to fight on behalf of the Confederacy. And then there is a big giant monument right there in front of our courthouse. And these were all put there by the different associations, like the Daughters of the Confederacy or the Sons of the Confederacy. And so I just feel like they're very inappropriate. It also gives a false impression of the history of this county, because while they sent a whole bunch of people, you know, over 1,000 to fight in the Confederacy, even though they didn't own any enslaved African, we're talking about poor white people who, you know, there weren't a whole lot of plantations around here. And I think the biggest plantation, if we want to call it that, or farm, had only about 20 enslaved Africans. But it was also a lot of support for Union troops here as well. There was a lot of support. So I felt like, you know, it's just a slap in the face of not only African descended people around here, but it also doesn't tell all the history. And I found it, you know, quite disturbing that they will have a monument right there at the courthouse to people who fought to enslave other people. It wasn't about states' rights. From my research, you know, even though they didn't own any enslaved Africans, they hoped to do that one day. And so that's why they fought, right? And so, but this county also, one, you know, going back to my ancestor by the name of Samuel Rankin, and one of his sons actually fought in the American Revolution, and Samuel provided supplies and whatnot, and that history isn't even being told. You have a monument to Confederate soldiers, but you have a real proven person who played a great role in the American Revolution, and where is his monument? So I agree with you. These things are important, and I feel like this is another way that racism continues to perpetuate itself throughout the generations. You have any thoughts?
Well, that's absolutely right, and I think it is important, you know, especially for our children to understand, you know, the complicated and controversial histories of our communities in the past. But it's one thing to educate them about history. It's another thing to extol that history or particular parts of that history by erecting monuments. So I totally agree with you.
And I get it. I get it. You know, those are your ancestors. They did what they did. I don't agree with what they did and whatnot. And I have very low opinion of them. But I'm also a reasonable person, and we have Confederate graveyards around here, and I'd be more than, you know, comfortable with that monument being relocated to where these men are buried. But it doesn't seem like that's ever going to happen soon. But, you know, after reading your story and how long it took, 8 years you were in this fight, along with some others who came along the way, that, you know, that just renewed in me a will and a desire to keep fighting to see these things change in my own community.
Well, I hope it does inspire you to do that, and I hope it inspires other people to stand up against racism in all of its forms, both symbolic and substantive. You know, on the one hand, people say, well, congratulations, you did it after 8 years. I look at it and say, my goodness, 8 years of work, all that for a simple name change. You know, how do we deal with the more entrenched facets of racism in our society? And I wrote an op-ed in the Seattle Times newspaper just this past week on that and said, well, we can change the name of the lake, and that's good. But I also know that the county just spent $215 million on a new youth jail in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my white daughters have their classmates in public school, classmates who are brown skinned, have five times more chance of ending up behind those youth jail doors than my children, simply because of the color of their skin. And that's wrong. And to me, that is the substance of racism today. So while it is good to change the name of a lake, we also have to recognize that it's just the beginning of the work that we have to do.
Right. Right.
As a society.
And I'm glad that you pointed that out in the Seattle Times, and to the listeners, I will link to the article so that you can read it for yourself. But when I read the article, you know, there was some conversation about your article on Facebook, and I was like, you know, Mr. Rosenblum seems fully informed, or in the very least, very informed about racism and how it works, not just on a, let's say, surface level, but I think that he rightly points out that this is only a start, you know, that we have a much more entrenched institutional racism in this society that we need to root out. But Mr. Rosenblum, I had interviewed artists by the name of John Sims. He had an op-ed piece in the Huffington Post as he was going around to about 13 different states, and this is when, you know, the whole thing in South Carolina was at its height to remove the Confederate flag, or the Virginia battle flag, to more accurately call it what it was. And, you know, he said that he was doing it because that, you know, if we cannot remove these visual symbols of racism from our society, then, you know, who are we to think then that we can tackle the more, you know, deeply rooted institutional racism that exists in this society? And I thought that was a very accurate statement by him. But, you know, I still feel like, you know, it's important because he called it an act of passive aggressive visual terrorism is what he called it. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree, and I would say that we need to use the struggles around these symbols, flags and lake names, not as an endpoint, and not to say simply let's root out all symbols of racism, but rather as a platform to then move to the substance of racism, to say, let's look at why unemployment is so disparate in different communities. Let's look at why a young black man has 21 times more chance of being shot by the police than a white person of the same age. Let's look at why youth incarceration of people of color is so much higher than for white people. Let's also ask, why are we even thinking about incarcerating youth rather than mm-hmm. helping them and teaching them, right? So I think it opens the door to some of the bigger questions and some of the more difficult questions that we have in society today. But to the extent that these name changes or the flag issue helps to create a conversation around that, a difficult conversation, then it's doing a service to humanity.
Yeah, it starts, it's a point of, to start the broader dialogue, that you spoke about. Is there anything that you would like to relay to our listeners in closing?
I think we've covered quite a few topics. I really appreciate your reaching out to me, Scotty, and I think just your radio show itself is providing a service, and I hope some of my white brothers and sisters listen in too. And get educated and think about what they can do to make this a more just society.
Well, I thank you for your contributions to counter racism and being one of those who are getting the conversation started in the community that you live in, so that we can then eventually tackle these more institutional issues of racism. You have a great day, Mr. Rosenblum.
Thank you very much, Scotty. I really appreciate being on your radio show. And
you are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Again, this is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines, known as USA Inc. I appreciated that interview, and I appreciate people like Mr. Rosenblum who take the initiative. I have heard some people say that only white people can end racism and white supremacy because non-white people don't have any power or the ability to do so. I don't agree with that. You know, there's a little truth to that. We are in a weakened state, but I believe you can do anything that you put your mind to. There are countless stories of people who we would say were powerless, who did some great things and achieved some great things. So I don't have that kind of attitude. I wasn't raised that way and whatnot. But if you do believe that only white people can end racism in this country, then we certainly should be encouraging more white people to end racism. 'Cause I'm tired. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the future, what the future looks like for African descended people, non-white people, poor people in this country. And my belief is what I was taught, what I have heard other people say, that it is upon each and every generation to press the fight until the war is won. And certainly the war isn't over. There's still a war against non-white people globally. And, you know, it's going to take people fighting in order to make any changes. Isn't it? You know, just simply sitting back and talking about it and not getting involved or, you know, minimizing other people's efforts, that is not going to end the system of racism on this planet. So I encourage, you know, I love to encourage people to follow their conscience and do whatever their conscience tells them to do. So I meant that with all sincerity. I appreciate the efforts of Mr. Rosenblum, and it doesn't appear that he is going to stop with that lake. As he addressed the institution of slavery that still exists in this country, as he mentioned, in the place that he lives, they just spent $250 million to spend a youth detention facility. I wonder how much they spent on public education. I bet you it wasn't $250 million. And so just based off of his commentary about that, I hope that he becomes more informed about what it exactly is, because names do matter, words do matter, and it's not mass incarceration, it's slavery. It's a continuation of the very evil pillar of this economy, of the U.S. economy, which is based on slavery. And that's still with us. But because, you know, we got people making movies and we got textbooks that are telling us that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, when in fact it did not. And it doesn't even say that. It has an exception clause in there. So I hope that he comes to the realization that he's not fighting against mass incarceration, but what he is fighting is a manifestation of a very old evil called slavery that has never been abolished on this continent. And I hope that he will become a new abolitionist, because we need all hands on deck. And you know, it's a problem that has been existing for far too long on this continent. Now I'm going to move on. I check the phone lines again. If you have any comments, any questions that you would like to ask, you can give us a call at 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032 pound, and just hit *61 to get in on the conversation. The studio line is 704-951-5030. 704-951-5030. So I want to transition to another manifestation of the very old evil called slavery in this country. As I said at the beginning of the broadcast, you have members of the communities up there in Minneapolis who have been engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience as they are led by Black Lives Matter activists. Shout out to Sister Nakia Levy Pounds, a new abolitionist. Also an attorney and a prominent member of the Black Lives Matter. I shouldn't say prominent. Everybody's important, but a leader in that movement in her area who just got out of jail last night. And she's been out there demonstrating, demanding that the Minneapolis Police Department releases and makes public the video of the killing of this young man by the name of Jamar Clark. So let me see if I can find Nakia's comments that she shares. She says that, "Friends, I'm tired, but I'm free. Blessed to have been in the company of such brave souls willing to be arrested last night, standing up for what they believe in. Thanks for all of your love, support, and encouragement. These arrests were not planned in advance of the demonstration. We each made a split-second decision to risk being arrested or to exit the freeway. We did it for Jamar and all of those whose lives have been senselessly lost to police violence. The time for justice is now. The time for freedom is now. The time for equality is now, not tomorrow, right now." And, of course, Justice for Jamar is her the hashtag that she used. So shout out to the activists up there in Minneapolis. Shout out to Sister Nakima Levy Pounds, a new abolitionist attorney representing up there in the state of Minneapolis. We'll try to get her to come on Friday if she is able to do, because we certainly don't want to take her away from the very important work that she's engaged in out there in the streets of her community. But we'll try to work something out. If we have to do a pre-recorded interview with her, then we'll do that. But I'm certainly proud of to know her, and proud to be her comrade. So black power to you, sis. All right. Let me just pull up some information in terms of what has been taking place in Minneapolis. Let me see. He was taken off Jamar Clark, he's 24, not 26. The 24-year-old black Minneapolis resident was shot by a Minneapolis Police Department officer, was taken off life support last night. This is information that's coming to you via citypages.com. I have linked to it if you want to read that article and share it. It says that news, which comes from statements Clark's family gave to Black Lives Matter organizers, had been expected for some time. Clark had been shot in the head at close range and was variously reported to be dead or on life support over the previous 2 days. But the controversial case of Clark, who was shot early Sunday morning, is very much alive, as evidenced by a large public demonstration Monday night that stopped traffic and led to dozens of arrests. You know, just like we heard from the activists down there in St. Louis and around Ferguson when they shut down the interstate, and the chant that I heard from some of them, or the battle cry, was no business as usual. No, you just don't get to go about your ordinary lives, as all of these black lives are being snuffed out on a daily basis. So sorry, you know, you're going to be a little late getting to wherever it is you're trying to get to. But we're out here engaging in civil disobedience, and we're going to get your attention. All right. So it went on to say that city and state officials have been quick to announce their interest in a thorough investigation of his case. And Mayor Betsy Hodges staged a press conference Monday evening to invite a Department of Justice review, as was done in similar controversial killings, including Trayvon Martin's killing in Florida and Michael Brown's shooting by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. See, that brings me back to what I was saying when I first came on air in reference to these Justice Department investigations. Let's not gloss over or ignore the fact that you got a woman by the name of Loretta Lynch, who is the new U.S. Attorney General. She has taken a different stance than her predecessor, Eric Holder, and said that she don't think it's important or it really matters if these police departments are required by law, because right now it's only a recommendation. Yeah, they passed a law to make a recommendation, all right, to police that they should report the number of people that they kill to a federal database, report those numbers to the Justice Department. And Eric Holder said that needs to happen, but Loretta Lynch does not agree. She feels like it's more important to work on community relations between police. Well, what better way to improve community relations than to start holding them accountable for the people that they kill unjustly in our communities? That if you want to work on truly concerned about the relationship between police, which I call modern slave catchers, and the communities that they patrolling for new slaves and whatnot, then, you know, certainly then you need to hold them accountable. And so we don't even really have an accurate count of how many people are being killed by police, because they're not all required to report. I don't know how many. I can't recall. I know I read a report that there are hundreds, you know, possibly over 300 little police departments, all, you know, some large, some small, some medium or whatnot. But not even a majority of the police departments report the number of people that they're killing. So we don't even got an accurate casualty count. So it could be far above. Let me check killed by police database. Let me just pull it up right quick. shouldn't take long. It's coming up right now. So as of today, you know, they are averaging, like I had said in programs past, about 3 people a day is what they're killing. As of November the 17th, a white male was the last victim in Texas. 41 years old white male was killed. He was numbered 1,045. Now, what if those numbers are actually, you know, if they were required to report and we were seeing, you know, double that amount? We were seeing, you know, something like 2,090 people killed by police. You know, would that concern some people then? You know, what if that's the accurate number? You know, would you then be ready to admit that there's a problem and you know, police are just using excessive force way too much? And it's been estimated that about 600 to 700 of these victims were unarmed. If I go by the information that I reported yesterday from the Counted, which is the database that's being maintained by the UK-based publication, The Guardian, where they estimated about a little over 400 white people, unarmed white people, have been killed, and something like 200 or so unarmed black people have been killed. But again, we don't got the true numbers because they are not required by any laws whatsoever to report this information. Sure, they can get all the federal government grants they want to prosecute a failed drug war and, you know, lock up and hunt down and lock up a bunch of undocumented immigrants and whatnot. But no, we don't want to require them to report the number of people that they're killing out here on these streets and rural communities and trailer parks and you know, they're killing everywhere. It's Battlefield America out there. So again, yes, you want the Justice Department to come in and do an investigation and whatnot, because they can uncover information that we can't uncover because we don't have the authority to go in there and go through their records. I feel like we should. You know, we paying taxes in a community, those should be open records. We should be able to go in there and sift through the databases and the reports, and you know, it should all be automated, put on a computer. It's not that hard to create these databases and whatnot. And so, you know, I just am really offended that Loretta Lynch, a black woman, no doubt, would say such a thing. You know, but it's kind of true to her history. She's always kind of been, you know, biased in favor of police. She's not an objective person. But this article that I'm reading about Mr. Jamar Clark, it says, you know, they mention the Justice Department investigation of Trayvon Martin's killing in Florida, which I think, you know, I don't even know for sure if that investigation has even been closed, because it drug on for at least 2 years. 2 years this was an open investigation into the killing of Trayvon Martin. I think they just, maybe earlier this year, they might have, you know, came to the conclusion that George Zimmerman did not violate his rights or whatever, even though he admitted to accosting this young man on the street, didn't have no business to be grabbing on him and asking him where he's going, and he wasn't involved in no criminal activity or anything like that. And so in the Michael Brown killing, you know, what did we see? We saw an investigation of an entire city that was engaged, according to the Justice Department, in racist patterns and practices. But guess what? We also uncovered that they violated federal statutes. They committed criminal acts. But guess what? We just don't think it's important to prosecute any of those people for violating federal statutes, for breaking the law, because see, the law only applies to black people. We only expect you to adhere to the law. We don't expect law enforcers to adhere to the law, you know. So again, I just don't see anything that positive that has ever come out of a Justice Department of Justice review. You know, if I look at it, that area of the government historically, hell, they're the reason why we got a lot of political prisoners like Mumia Abu-Jamal, like Russell Schultz, like Leonard Peltier, like, you know, a number of that's why Assata Shakur is, you know, being forced to live in Cuba and whatnot because of the Justice Department and their activities in working with police to target black people out there and American Indians and anti-war groups and targeting them. So there, I don't see why anybody other than to get information that they can't get to from these reports issued by the Justice Department. Other than that, I would temper my expectations of any justice coming out the Justice Department. It doesn't happen. It very rarely happens. Yeah, you'll get the occasional hate crime conviction. You know, you'll have a U.S. attorney prosecute somebody under hate crime statutes and whatnot, and you'll get a couple of convictions and like. But they don't do anything to address the institutional, the systemic racism. Okay. Yeah, they'll go after some individuals and whatnot, but they seem very, very not seem. They are reluctant. I think the evidence shows they are reluctant to tackle institutional racism. Even when they do the investigation and find violations of constitutional rights, violations of actual federal criminal penal code laws, they're not interested in prosecuting people. Very rare. Very rare. I'm not going to say it's never happened, but, you know, it's just very rare for it to happen. So anybody, you know, that expects justice to come out the Justice Department just because you got black people that work in these places, nah, temper your expectation and just use them to get information. And what we need is for people like Attorney of the Year for Minnesota, Nakia Levy-Pam. We need to be starting an organization, a legal foundation that will start, take that information, and then go after these people in the civil courts and sue them under RICO charges, under RICO laws that were designed to tackle organized crime. And we are talking about organized crime. Don't just think, when you think of organized crime, don't think just of the mob. Don't think just of, you know, Mexican drug cartels. Don't think of, you know, street gangs and things like that. No, think about your government. Think about agencies within your government. They are engaged in patterns and practices of criminal enterprise, and they're profiting. Look at the civil assets forfeiture programs. Think yesterday, I might have played a clip, or I might have been listening to, no, I was listening to the Context of White Supremacy's Saturday night compensatory call-in, where the black man in New York City, I forget if it was the Bronx or somewhere else, and he had $1,300 in his pocket to pay the rent, and he doesn't deal with banks. He uses check cashers and whatnot, and you know, his wife had gave him some money, so they had to go pay the rent, and he had that in his pocket at the time that he was just stopped for driving while black, wasn't charged with any criminal offenses, but they tried to keep his money. They tried to keep his money, and he had to go through a whole lot of bureaucratic red tape just to recover his $1,300, because the NYPD was going to rob him blind, like many law enforcement departments are robbing people all across this country. So, yeah. This is organized crime, people. This is organized crime. So we don't want to say last night protesters turned up the heat with their most visible disruptive demonstration yet, shutting down traffic on I-94 for more than an hour to bring attention to their cause. Though they applauded Hodges' call for a DOJ investigation, meeting one of their demands, Black Lives Matter protesters have also called for the video to become public, as well as the names of the police officers involved in Clark's incident. More than 300 people turned up at the start of the rally, according to BLM, and 51 of them, 43 adults and 8 juveniles, still refused to leave when Minnesota State Patrol and Minneapolis cops ordered them to get out the road. Each one was released without bail. early this morning. I don't think they meant to write it that they didn't have to post bond. They were probably released on their own reconnaissance. One of the arrested, Nakima Levy Pounds, president of the Minneapolis NAACP, who posted on Facebook after she was let out of jail, explaining that forcing arrest was not part of their original plan. And I've already read her statement to you. You can find her on Facebook as well, and I shared it on my personal profile. So, yeah, do whatever you have to do, as Malcolm X said, by any means necessary. Engage in that. Engage in that civil disobedience. I certainly send my support to you for whatever it's worth. All right, the last thing that I want to cover first, I'm going to take a station identification break. Perhaps kick some little message music and whatnot. And then when we come back, I'll jump on this last story that I want to talk about the Pew Research Center published a study examining why the death rates among whites are exceeding birth rates. And the glaring omission, I don't know if it was intentional or if it was just an oversight, but I saw a glaring, a very big omission on what's contributing to more white people dying than white people being born in this country. All right, so you're listening to Black Talk Radio News. I broadcast every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time right here on the Black Talk Radio Network. Again, just to remind you of some of the live programming coming up today. On November the 17th, Tando Radio Show will be coming on at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern tonight will be an episode of Why You Mad Son Radio. All right, I'll be right back on the other side.
The power structure has successfully created the image of the American Negro as someone with no confidence, no militancy. And they had done this by giving him images of heroes that weren't truly militant or confident. And now here come Cassius, the exact contrast of everything that was representative of the Negro image. He said he was the greatest. All of the odds were against him. He upset the odds makers. He won. He became victorious. He became the champ. They knew that as soon as if people began to identify with Cassius and the type of image he was creating, they were going to have trouble out of these Negroes, because they'd have Negroes walking around the street saying, "I'm the greatest, 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 greatest."
How do you describe desperation to someone who is not desperate? He had a letter to me from U.S. political prisoner Ojibwe Mutulo, who went on to depict everyone in the management control unit at Trenton State being woken up at 1 o'clock in the morning by guards dressed in riot gear, holding dogs. This country was born out of genocide. That's the political genesis of the slavery system, the political genesis of the prison system. This country was born out of genocide. That's the political genesis of the slavery system, the prison system. And this country was born out of genocide.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Again, my name is Scotty Reed. Now, again, let me just give you a disclosure. Now, see, I didn't look at the date on this Pew Research Center report, but this report actually came out in 2013. But it had gotten a resurgence on social media just last week. A lot of people were sharing this and they were discussing it and whatnot. I don't know why they brought it back up, but now I'm looking at the date on this and it says June 14, 2013. It is published on pewresearch.org, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. And the title of this is Why There Are More Deaths Than Births Among Whites. So let me share some of this. It's not very long, so I'm going to read it to you because I think there's a big glaring omission. The finding that made headlines from this week's Census Bureau release of new national and state population estimates that there are now more deaths than births among non-Hispanic whites is a vivid illustration of the rapid long-term growth in the number of older Americans. But first, you might ask, how could there suddenly be more deaths than births given that American lifespans are so long? One key reason is that U.S. birth rates and the number of births have dropped since the onset of the Great Recession in late 2007. And non-Hispanic whites also have a below average birth rate. Another reason is the age makeup of the non-Hispanic white population. It is older than other groups and includes a lower share of women in their childbearing years. And they have a little chart that shows non-Hispanic white alone population nearly 15 years older than Hispanic population, but they also include the classification of black people and Asians as well. For now, the non-Hispanic white population is still growing because of immigration from abroad. Now, that kind of stood out to me yesterday as we see, you know, a lot of people, you know, it is a presidential election cycle right now. And, you know, immigration has been a huge issue going back for a very long time in this country. But we don't never hear those people that are out there opposed to all these non-white undocumented immigrants coming here because, you know, corporations in the U.S. government's drug war has made the places where they're coming from pretty much inhabitable in terms of there are no jobs and, you know, you got to worry about getting killed by narco terrorists and whatnot. And so, you know, but they never talk about immigration of all these white people that's sustaining their numbers and keeping it stable, but they're coming from abroad. You know, I imagine that would be Chechens and other people coming from Eastern Europe and you know, I don't know. It doesn't say if they're coming for any particular country or whatnot, but they never talk about cutting down those immigration numbers. And the reason why is because from my intel gathering of listening to right-wing talk radio and whatnot, and I've noticed this for a very long time. I mean, going back to when I first really started listening to talk radio back in 2001, I would say sometime in 2000, that I would hear some of these white male talk show hosts, man, begging white people to have more babies, saying that, you know, our population numbers are dwindling. So, you know, they are worried about, you know, being erased as a racial classification, I guess is the accurate way to put it, and whatnot. And, you know, so anyway, I thought that was interesting that their population is still growing only because of immigration from abroad. But that's never brought up. You know, they don't tell those people to go back to where you came from and whatnot and all of that. So anyway, it goes on to say, but both the Census Bureau and the Pew Research Center have forecast that the number of white non-Hispanic Americans would decline in coming decades as the death to birth ratios grows faster than could be offset by immigration. the recent fertility downturn may have sped up the growth of the death to birth ratio from July the 1st, 2011 to July 1st, 2012, the Census Bureau estimates there were about 12,000 more deaths among non-Hispanic whites than births. Non-Hispanic whites are the bulwark of the nation's giant post-World War II baby boom generation. The first of this group turned 65 in 2011, and 10,000 a day are forecast to do so in the coming decades through 2029. The Census Bureau recently projected that the share of Americans ages 65 and older would rise to 20% by 2013, compared with 13.7% in 2012. The working age population, people's ages 18 to 64, is projected to decline as a share of the total, as is the share of children. So that's the entire report. Again, this report came out in 2013. I did not know that when I took a look at it as it was being shared, you know, among the people in my circle on social media. But there is a big glaring omission here that would help to explain why you got more white people dying than white people being born. And that big omission is all of these unnecessary wars that are going on. You know, right now, what are they talking about? Putting boots on the ground there in Syria and whatnot, and ramping up things in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, you know, ever since World War II, there have been a number of countless engagements of the United States military troops all around this world in undeclared wars. And when I say undeclared wars, it's war. Definitely warfare being waged, but these are undeclared wars where Congress, according to the Constitution, is supposed to, you know, declare war on a nation and whatnot. And so, you know, now we don't necessarily have nation versus nation on the battlefield. We got nations versus proxies of nations going on the battlefield. And, you know, the president no longer has to go to the board members of USAE and ask for a declaration of war and whatnot. All he has to do, well, in the case of President Obama invading Libya and practicing regime change there following the Bush doctrine, you know, they just pretty much just do what the hell they want to do and don't seek permission from anyone. And just go to war, just commit troops and whatnot. But we're seeing, I was doing some research for a different article or a different conversation I was having. And sometimes I just do research because that's what I like to do. And I was looking at the racial breakdown of the United States military. I think it has something to do with Veterans Day, and I was doing research and trying to determine, you know, what is the racial classification of all these veterans that are in prison. Up to 1 million are in prison or in jail behind nonviolent drug offenses, trying to treat their PTSD, since the Veterans Administration is worthless agency and whatnot. And don't even get me to start talking about my family's personal challenges with the VA and trying to get health care and whatnot. But, you know, I was looking at that, and that's when I discovered that most of the majority of combat troops in the U.S. military, we're talking about combat troops, we're talking about infantry, we're talking about artillery, people that are actively on the battlefield. Even though a war zone may be declared for an entire area, that's not necessarily meaning that, you know, you got people on opposing sides shooting at each other. So, but on that battlefield where there's active shooting and shelling and bombing going on, 69% of the combat troops are white males. Again, that's 69% of the combat troops are white males. And considering how this country has been engaging in all of these undeclared wars time and time again. You know, ain't fully even out of Iraq or Afghanistan. They already ready to ramp it up and send some people into Syria, put boots on the grounds, and we're screaming for it. And it has to do with profit mainly, you know, the profits of the military industrial complex and whatnot. But I felt like that was a glaring omission by the Pew Research to leave out the fact that you got a lot of white males that's dying on the battlefield out there, that's getting blown to bits, getting shot the hell up, and whatnot. So how could you not put that into your equation? You know, I don't know. I suppose we could look it up, but I don't suppose that they would want to really give you the true numbers of just how many U.S. troops you are losing. You know, the information might be out there. It may not be out there. But I'm willing to bet that the vast majority of those being killed in action are white males on that battlefield from all these undeclared wars and whatnot. And I feel like that is perhaps a key, one of, if not the key reason, but one of the key reasons that white deaths are now exceeding white births. And then we're talking about what? Young men that are in child producing years and whatnot, and they're not getting the opportunity to start families and whatnot because they're getting killed on the battlefield as they go out there as proxies of this racist system and of the corporations and whatnot out there trying to take another country's resources and prop up the U.S. dollar, the Federal Reserve note that ain't backed by nothing. It's as worthless as Monopoly money in your Monopoly game and whatnot. And the only way that the U.S. currency remains one of the reserve currencies, as Brother Dave talks about on Tando Radio Show, is through warfare. Which is, again, one of the reasons they overthrew Gaddafi, because he was going to introduce, or he was working on introducing, an African, United African currency, black backed by gold dinars. That would send that petrodollar tumbling down so far that, they couldn't. So let's go kill him. Let's go assassinate this man and whatnot. So I just thought there was a glaring omission on the part of the Pew Research Center, and I don't know if that was intentional. I don't know if that was just oversight on their part, and perhaps they just don't want to raise the alarm among white people that, hey, I know you thirst for the blood and the killing of all these non-white people around the world, and you just want to stomp them out and bomb them, you know, back into the Stone Ages, as I recall some of the comments I've heard from these people. But guess what? It's also leading to a decline in our population numbers. So they don't want to tell them that. They don't want to tell them that the white people classified as white are in danger of extinction because, guess what? They're waging too much war around the planet on other people. So I just thought it was very important to bring up and point that out. Pew Research Center is respected among people as being, you know, a credible source. And I just was expecting a little bit more, and I felt like there was a big glaring omission. All right, I don't have anything else for you today. Again, coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, Tando Radio Show will be on air. Brother Dave told me what the topic was, but I think he'll be talking a little bit more. He asked me to be on the program and asked me to talk about what we heard from Drake yesterday and Wade yesterday. For those that haven't been listening, Drake claims to be, you know, a representative of the American Patriot, underground, that's he says exists in his country, and that there are going to be some moves made, and they need to send a message to the black community and whatnot. And so Brother Dave wanted me to chime in with him on some afterthoughts about what was heard yesterday on the program. He will also continue to talk about false flags and why they continue to be effective. All right. And make sure y'all tune back into the live station, or don't never tune out. This station is 24/7, If there's not any live streaming going on, there is some pre-recorded programming that we have uploaded to the station for your access to information that we like to share. All right, recognize the fact that you live behind enemy lines. It's a battlefield out there. Casualties are being created every day. New slaves are being hunted down to put on the new plantations and whatnot. And so that you don't become one of them casualties out there, you need to develop battlefield awareness. You need to develop battlefield skills so that you can avoid the traps and pitfalls that are out there. But at the same time, there's no guarantees that you won't become a victim. You could just be walking down the street and just get blown away by these cops, man, out here. Or, you know, some of these people who are engaged in unconstructive activities in our community. So there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. And then there are some cases where we need to put our life on the line so that we can end this global system of racism, because it's not going to end itself. And we need all hands on deck. We need everybody on the front line. Everybody can't be on the front line. Some got to be in support positions. But the point is we need soldiers for justice out there. So if that takes me dying, if that takes, you know, me giving up my life, then I would gladly do that. Certainly, you know, I didn't have a problem with signing up in the United States military to get the GI Bill and got sent off to the Gulf War. So if I would put my life on the line and not declare that I'm a conscientious objector and I don't believe in warfare and whatnot, then certainly now that I'm more conscious about what's going on in the world and how it works, and how racism works in the world, then I should be more than willing to put my life on the line in the pursuit of justice. Peace and blessings to all. Be safe out there. You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
I got so much trouble on my mind, refuse to lose. Here's your ticket. Hear the drummer get wicked.